across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is
The
Stephen Nolan
Show! The Chief Constable blasts the politicians at Stormont. And despite them denying it to The Nolan Show, Boucher doesn't think there are hard commitments in the programme for government for policing. He has this chilling message for our politicians.
I do worry that it will take some catastrophic event to wake everybody up to the reality of our policing numbers and lead the investment that's required.
Also in Nolan this morning, the Chief Constable says the PSNI is liaising with the Met Police over the case offender, Zhen Hao Zhou.
So I would appeal to anybody who met him or in any way was alone with him in any of the circumstances, this is another opportunity to reinforce that and they come forward and speak to us.
And a massive row in the GAA over where an Ulster Senior Football Championship match will be played. Antrim and Armagh are meeting in the quarter-finals. Antrim GAA say they still expect to stage the game at home, despite Ulster GAA switching the game. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning, everyone. A damning statement from the Chief Constable, John Boucher. He has blown out of the water any suggestion that Stormont is trying to put about, that their programme for government has given any firm commitment for funding for policing. And that is what your politicians have been trying to put about. You know it, because we've been covering it every day this week on The Nolan Show. And Boucher has gone further. He's criticised these politicians in a chilling message in which he is saying that, are people going to have to die or get seriously injured before they realise they're going to have to put more money into policing?
I do worry that it will take some catastrophic event to wake everybody up to the reality of our policing numbers and lead the investment that's required.
So, let's get you across what he told the policing board when he was explaining how the shortfall in police numbers was affecting the fight against paramilitaries.
The recently republished seventh report of the Independent Reporting Commission, the IRC, made clear that a strong policing response remains fundamental to tackling and ending paramilitarism. We have a very productive relationship with the commissioners and I welcome their report. The IRC sets out the crucial role of neighbourhood policing teams in effectively dealing with paramilitary activity. I share their and communities' considerable frustrations at the constant requirement to extract neighbourhood policing officers to other areas of policing. I promise you we would not do this if it was not absolutely necessary. Simply, we have no choice, as we need to deploy these resources elsewhere to deal with wider risk to the organisation. And this is a consequence of our dangerously low and unacceptable numbers. No one knows the value of neighbourhood policing more than the people sitting beside me. Quite simply, we no longer have the numbers we require to police Northern Ireland. Anywhere else, those statements would be headlines. The fight against paramilitarism also requires detectives to investigate and to manage intelligence. It requires specially trained and equipped search teams and officers who are able to respond to public disorder. You'll be aware from the recent recovery business plan that we submitted that we have fewer officers in all of these specialisms than we've ever had before. The IRC too have acknowledged the importance of properly resourcing the fight against paramilitarism and have correctly highlighted the significant under-resourcing of the Justice Department compared to other departments in recent years and how this is impacting our ability to deliver vital services. Next month, His Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary and Fire Rescue Services will deliver its annual report on the PSNI's effectiveness and efficiency. From the early conversations with the inspector, I believe the report will again, and I emphasise the word again, set out our critically low police numbers and the impact that's having on keeping people in Northern Ireland safe. I expect the board will reflect many of the concerns I have previously raised with regard to our ability to protect vulnerable people, manage dangerous offenders, and provide victims with the services that they deserve. These are the inevitable consequences of years of underfunding in the face of growing demand and changing complexities. Like many who doubtless responded to the programme for government consultation, I await reassurances similar to those provided to Health yesterday that these independent reports setting out the unacceptable policing numbers and the consequences to our society will be provided. Not just because so many independent bodies have stated this, but also because your Chief Constable keeps repeating it. The programme for government published this week is asking for plenty from policing again in terms of collaboration, speeding up justice and enhancing public safety. We will play the best role our numbers allow in the key priorities of ending violence against women and girls and creating safer communities. However, it's crucially important and fundamental to the security of Northern Ireland that a sufficient and more sustainable funding settlement is achieved for policing if we are to deliver these priorities. I did not see any explicit executive commitment to that in the document. I do welcome the programme's commitment to growing officer numbers and supporting our recovery business case. However, as I've said when the document was in draft, I do not feel the programme for government properly reflects the level of crisis in policing in Northern Ireland, and I will keep making that clear until it is addressed. I would welcome clear statements from ministers outlining support for the recovery plan in the terms of both numbers and funding. I do believe that I've been heard in broad terms about resourcing. It is my belief that there is a cross-party political acceptance that the police service has been severely underfunded and allowed to shrink to unacceptably low numbers. However, actions speak louder than words. That is why it's disappointing the executive have missed this opportunity to provide clarity and to strengthen its commitments to properly resourcing this organisation. There's been much publicity about the funding levels quoted for cutting health waiting times, which I do welcome, but no such reassurances have yet been provided for policing. The implications of our reduced workforce levels and continual budget pressures are certainly severe, but please be in no doubt of how serious this really is. We are at significant risk of failing victims, local communities and our own workforce. This is dangerous for a society which continues to emerge from the traumas of a post-conflict environment. And every time I come before this board, there are examples of that in what's happened in the previous 4 weeks. Not only have I called out the dangerously low policing numbers since my appointment in October 2023, I've been supported by the HMIC FRS, as I've already mentioned, the Independent Reporting Commission, the Criminal Justice Inspectorate for Northern Ireland and the Northern Ireland Affairs Committee. We are now very far from the executive commitment of New Decade, New Approach to 7,500 officers. I do worry that it will take some catastrophic event to wake everybody up to the reality of our policing numbers and lead the investment that's required, which is relatively small with regards to the public service spend.
Well, there you have it. And just drink that in for a moment or two, what the man in charge of policing in Northern Ireland is saying. One, he's saying the programme for government, nothing in it. Despite them sitting and smiling at you and telling you that there were commitments in that for policing, he's telling you what we've been telling you, there aren't. There aren't hard numbers in that document for policing. Secondly, he's calling out the politicians. He's calling out Stormont. And he's essentially saying, what are they going to do? Are they going to wait for there to be a massive incident in Northern Ireland? Obviously, he's talking about catastrophic event. That means people dying or people getting seriously injured, where otherwise, if he had the numbers, he might be able to stop it. And he's saying, are they going to wait, these politicians? He says they're going to wait for that to happen, for people to be involved in a catastrophic event before they'll fund the police service. Pretty damning, Alison Morris, Belfast Telegraph's crime correspondent. He's calling them out, but will they do anything about it, or will they continue to pretend they've given policing money in this programme for government when they have not?
The problem is, and I was at that policing board meeting, and you could hear the frustration in the chief constable's voice, because he has been saying this for quite some time, and that statement he made in relation to the sort of catastrophic incident, he has also stressed that point before as well. And we do know that at the minute, I think we're sitting at around 6,300 officers. There's also a portion of those who are off on the sick, and there's also delays to our criminal justice system as a result of this. I think the recruitment drive that's ongoing at the minute that plans to add 700 officers to that number to bring it up to 7,000 requires 200 million over the next 5 years, and there's no real commitment as to where that is coming from. The Chief Constable started that recruitment drive without having that funding secured, just because there was no contingency plan. They didn't even have a pool of officers to draw from to make up for the shortfall in terms of retirements and things that were going on every year. So the problem is, when we talk about officer numbers, sometimes it's in isolation, but you have to put it in context of the into the context of the entire criminal justice system. So it doesn't just mean if you make call-outs that it's going to take longer for maybe officers to arrive. It's a knock-on effect in terms of court cases. So I sit in the courts quite regularly, and you can hear as they do management, you know, as case management hearings are ongoing, and they say, what about the trial, can it go on this date? And they'll say, no, that officer's off sick, or that officer's not available, or it'll be, you know, the evidence in that case hasn't been presented, we haven't had the file yet. And then all of this delays it, and the longer it delays, then you get things like women dropping out of cases as witnesses, and that contributes to the violence against women and girls we have here in Northern Ireland, and the high numbers that we have. So the whole thing has a massive knock-on effect, and I do think that the politicians need to really sit down. If they have a strategy for end violence against women and girls, why then does that not include properly funding the PSNI?
Let's contrast the Chief Constable, John Boucher, and his assessment that there is nothing in that programme for government in terms of hard numbers, in terms of an amount towards policing, that means that he is feeling that he can get on with at least the basic job here of keeping people safe. Let's contrast that to what the Deputy First Minister, Emma Little-Pengelly, said when she was speaking to me on Nolan Live on Wednesday night about policing and in the programme for government.
So that's not accurate. What we refer to in that commitment is the NDNA, the New Decade, New Approach numbers. That is very clear.
But that's not a hard commitment that you will definitely do it.
Figures. But look, this is one that requires money. You need money in order to recruit more police
officers.
You need
to prioritise money from your global budget.
Yeah, look, I think when you look across, when people say about the ambition of this, it's very ambitious, right? If you look across this programme for government, you look at the additional money required for health, hundreds of millions of pounds. When you look at the money required for PSNI recruitment, probably looking at about £200 million to get up above the 7,000 figure. When you look at the money required for an affordable childcare strategy, this is all money that needs to be prioritised.
So when you were sitting around the table, how did you cut
it
off?
This is the hard part of politics. That's why those around the executive will have to do their best to find that money and reprioritise or prioritise towards this.
So over the last year, that's what they're supposed to have been doing. Sitting down and working out what are they prioritising, how much money are they putting towards it, and they were supposed to have delivered to the public of Northern Ireland and people like Boucher and people that are at the top of the health service. They were supposed to have delivered their worked out plans as to what they were going to do, what they were therefore not going to do, and have money against it so that they could say, this is now workable. And they haven't done it. And here we are a couple of days later with our Chief Constable saying, policing isn't safe. And are these people, these politicians in Northern Ireland, are they going to have a catastrophic event before they realise what they've left us with? Roy McComb, former Deputy Director of the National Crime Agency, former Senior PSNI Officer. You know, some Chief Constables in the past might have chosen their words slightly more politely, But Roy Boucher's going after them. He's calling them out.
Well, good morning, Stephen. You have a chief constable here who is saying in public what I'm almost certain he is saying in private. So he's not saying anything that's going to come as a surprise to those ministers that he's engaged with. But this is the equivalent of somebody in the crow's nest on the Titanic saying there's an iceberg ahead and he's waiting for somebody to change the direction of the ship. He's been very clear, very articulate. He's not using particularly alarmist language. He's not shroud waving. He's saying there is a real danger here that we will not be able to deliver ordinary policing as well as the policing response to the more dangerous and more sophisticated organised crime groups, or indeed those rump number of terrorist organisations that we still have. So when the Chief Constable has said this, not once, but several times from his appointment in October 2023, I think it's incumbent on politicians to listen and to take action.
Surprisingly to me, Alison, people are stopping me in the street talking about the programme for government because I didn't think they would be that interested in it. They are talking to me about it. So to remind people what's actually been delivered in that document this week around policing, it says develop a robust business case that will seek to stabilise and begin to grow police officer numbers. In other words, they haven't developed that yet. And they are still where they were last year before this document was even considered.
Yeah, and it seems like an afterthought. And the problem is that you do need to sit down and plan these things out years in advance. You know, you have to look at how it's going to build. You have to look at how you're going to replace officers who are retiring or leaving the force. And then you actually do get greater numbers leaving if they're short staffed because people are under too much pressure and decide they don't want to work in that kind of environment. And so the whole thing then spirals. I mean, just to give an example, one of the other things that was discussed at the policing board yesterday was the number of officers who are currently suspended facing investigation. And that is something the public are generally interested in. They want to know if officers are accused of wrongdoing, it's dealt with correctly. The Deputy Chief Constable, Bobby Singleton, said that the professional standards part of the PSNI that internally investigates its own officers is currently working at 40% capacity. And they cannot replace the officers that should be in that department working, because to do that would mean to take them off live investigations that could be, you know, murder investigations, organised crime investigation, terrorist related investigations. So you'd be begging, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul. And therefore then you have a 3.5 million bill of officers who are being paid while being suspended, being investigated by either the police ombudsman and then the professional standards. So, you mean, you can see how all of this has an impact on confidence in policing, how we view policing and the wider justice system. It just makes a very unsafe system, and that's not something any of us want, but it should be planned out years ahead. I think that the problem we have with our stormont government is that when they do these things, they seem to be trying just to get over the next year, get over the hump, get over this problem, get over this crisis, rather than say, how can we prevent this happening again, and let's look forward to the next 3 years, four years, 5 years.
Right, could make this real for us in terms of if John Boucher doesn't get the money and he's saying our police service will be unsafe.
Yeah.
Make that real for us as to what choices he will have to make. What do you think he will lose?
Well, I'll give you real examples. As the former head of organised crime in Northern Ireland, I had to make decisions over a five and a half year period on a monthly basis, sometimes a weekly basis, and quite frequently a daily basis as to how I deployed my resources against the organised crime threats facing the country at that time. Since then, the threat from organised crime has got materially more significant. We've seen larger drug seizures. We've seen weapons coming in from overseas. We've seen deaths because of the control that organised crime groups are exposing the country to. So those decisions that I would have had to have made are now much more difficult and with a much more reduced capability. So every day, the leadership of PSNI are having to make decisions based on a risk versus availability of resources scenario. And that becomes more difficult when you have fewer resources and an increasing threat. So worst case scenario, the threat is increasing from particularly organised crime groups. the demand from the public for normal policing services is increasing, which is a good sign on its own, but the capability and the availability of resources is going in the opposite direction, which means that decisions being taken by police officers, leaders on a day-to-day basis, are having to pay, as Alison has said, rob Peter to pay Paul. So these are not just theoretical conceptual spreadsheet numbers. These are actual decisions that operational police officers are having to take on a day-to-day basis. And you can only do that for so long, Stephen, before eventually you make a mistake or you end up with insufficient capability and somebody ends up dying. And I think the Chief Constable has been very clear on that point. Do we have to wait until there's a catastrophic event before we take a significant leap forward in the capability of PSNI?
Alison, here's what I'm trying to understand in terms of the political element of this. You know, these politicians, these government ministers who signed off that programme for government, and they actually put their personal signatures to that document. They live within us, within our community. They do care. Like, it's just vacuous to suggest they don't. How did they sit down, look into a camera, take a group photograph, smile at it, put their signature to a document, knowing that the Chief Constable had raised this prospect of people dying in this country, and not put a hard figure or an organised plan into that document for policing? Like, what are they in politics for if they're prepared to be content with that?
Well, I mean, I do agree that, you know, the vast majority of people who I've met here in politics entered for the right reasons, you know, and they do care about the communities they live in and the constituency they live in. The issue is, I think, that when they're sitting down to devise that programme for government and to look at the pot of money that they have, that they were looking at health and education first, and health was always the big one. And you could
They didn't make any guarantees for it.
But you could take the entire budget, you could take the entire budget for Northern Ireland for the year and give it to health, and you still couldn't fix everything that's wrong with it. It's not much of a mess. But I work in you know, my job is crime and security, and so I see the sort of, I suppose, hard edge of how underfunded the justice system is and the impact that has on people. And that's everything from the overcrowding in the prisons, because the overcrowding in prisons is directly linked to the pace at which our courts work, which is far slower than anywhere else. In any other jurisdiction in these islands, either in the south of Ireland or the rest of the UK, you will be waiting here for a trial up until 3 years. There's current trials going through the courts that have been in the system, some of them 6 and 7 years. We were told yesterday that there's one police officer who has been suspended, facing investigation for coming up to 8 years. 8 years on pay. Why, that's ongoing. And all the while, you know, we've
seen... That's unbelievable. That is unbelievable.
Shocking. This disastrous situation that has arisen in terms of the funding of policing, which has left those numbers dangerously short. And it looks nothing like what the Patton report had said was going to be the new beginning, the new vision for policing when the PSNI came into existence in 2001. It was supposed to be not a security-led police force. It was supposed to be a community-led police service. And to do that requires proper funding and proper officer numbers so that people think they're getting a good service. And if not, then you'll see that opinion polls will show that confidence in policing becomes shockingly low for various different reasons, because people don't know that there's police in numbers until they come to need the police. But when they do, it's usually at a really traumatic time in their life. And then they're lifting the phone and not getting the service they require.
And Roy McComb, John Boucher is saying anywhere else this would be headline news. Anywhere else people would be very, very exercised about this. And yet here in Northern Ireland, there's no political outcry. The politicians have been invited to come on this morning. They're not available. And so it will go on, and so it will move on until there's a catastrophic event. And then presumably either the police will be blamed or people will bring up, why didn't you invest in them?
Well, I think Alison has made the point that take it down from the extreme where people could end up dying, but the routine phone calls that the citizens of Northern Ireland are making for assistance, calls for service, from the police, how many of them are not getting the response that the public expects. And when that is failing the public, then that ends up being complaints against the police. And that's where the trust and confidence of policing begins to diminish. And it's then that the public point the finger at the police and they don't hear the arguments that the chief constable is saying in private, which he's now raised into the public scenario to say, I've been saying this for 18 months. At what point are we going to change?
It goes. Should he not be more efficient? Can he not find money within his police service?
Listen, having worked in the police service for 30 years, I know that on a day-to-day basis, there are conversations going on about how to spread the money around. So there isn't an issue of efficiency and effectiveness that doesn't take place. I'm not saying that there aren't economies of scale that could be made, but unlike any force in England and Wales where they can call upon mutual aid, Northern Ireland cannot. In extremis, they can for the likes of the G8 summit and presidential visits and whatnot, but we have to be self-sufficient in Northern Ireland. And when there aren't enough resources there, then it becomes incredibly difficult and sometimes things have to fall off the edge of the demand.
Is there another political point in here, Alison? So if you have the chief constable calling out this programme for government and saying it's not good enough, Naomi Long, the justice minister, signed it off. I wonder, she was one of the ministers that signed it off. So I wonder, did Naomi sit down with the chief constable of Northern Ireland and discuss what was or wasn't in that programme for government before signing it off? Or is he also calling her out?
Well, he's calling them all out, but yes, he would deal more directly with the Department of Justice than he would with any of the other ministers. And we know that that relationship can be a bit touchy at times, because we could see that last year when the Chief Constable directly wrote to London and said that he needed more money, there was a bit of, I suppose, tension that occurred between himself and the Justice Department, who said that that wasn't how things were done and that he shouldn't be going on a solo run trying to get more money. And he obviously, John Boucher is a very different kind of chief constable to Simon Byrne. You know, he's his own man and he's going to go and do what he feels is the right thing to do at that time for the officers and for his for the service that he's running. So they say that the working relationship between them is good. I think that it can be a little bit tense at times. And the Department of Justice, you know, is the Justice Minister is responsible for that. She's responsible for, I suppose, lobbying within that executive team for her department, and that includes prisons, you know, courts, and it includes policing.
My point, Alison, is that Naomi Long, in her role as Justice Minister, has signed off a programme for government which has no hard and fast amounts of money or commitments to policing. And the chief constable is publicly saying, he's not naming Naomi, but he's saying this isn't good enough. And Naomi signed off that document.
Yeah, and we have seen publicly spats that have occurred between, say, health and the executive, where the previous health minister and the current health minister has said, you know, we'll not be signing that if we don't get no more money. This isn't good enough. This budget is inadequate. But we don't hear that in terms of justice. And because I work in that field, and that's what I write about most often, I can see that there's as big a crisis happening within our Justice Department as is happening within health and education infrastructure. It's just something that people, I suppose, consider doesn't really affect them until it does. And when it does, you know, it's usually, as they said, at a very traumatic time. And then you realise just how underfunded it is, whether that comes to the length of time it's taken for inquests to happen, for criminal trials to happen, whether that's the overcrowding in the prisons, whether that's the fact that police officers are having to act as mental health workers sitting in A&Es with people who are in mental health crisis rather than not being dealt with by the health service. And all of those things all build up. And so I do think that relationship, I'm not sure how it is now, but I imagine that John Boucher wouldn't be one to mince his words. He'll say what he thinks, and he'll not be as diplomatic maybe as some of the previous chief constables.
The Department of Justice is telling us this morning, they've been in contact with us this morning to say that the business case is now in the Department of Finance. But I'm sorry, why was it not in the Department of Finance, distributed among all of the ministers, and something definitive in a programme for government? That is a fair question, Roy McComb. Why was that business case not ready in there? Like, how many months and months do they need to work these things out?
Well, you've probably seen business cases in your own professional life, Stephen, and sometimes there's so many words used to describe a very straightforward scenario. And I imagine what the Chief Constable has said in the business case is, we don't have enough resources. Here's the projection of what we're going to have over the next 5 years. The Patton report of over 20 years ago said the organisation should be 7,500 strong. It hasn't reached 7,500 except when it was reducing from the numbers in the RUC. So we're at a position now where we're at 6,700, aspirationally to get to 7,500. It's a very clear request. The justification is based on the evidence around the crime and the threat and the risk within Northern Ireland. I don't think it's a particularly difficult case to make, and it's being shrouded, I think, in the ambiguity of government around the other demands from health and from education from elsewhere. But, you know, at some point, we're going to end up talking about the impact of having insufficient officers or insufficient specialist officers doing the work that we expect them to do. And we're going to end up with that catastrophic event that the Chief Constable said. I think, as you know, having worked or having met John Boucher previously, he is a very clear-spoken, very level-headed and a very capable Chief Constable. And he's saying on behalf of the people of Northern Ireland what needs to be said. So,
Let's go back
a little bit of a maid. I know we should muddy the waters, but we read this week about this this individual who was convicted of multiple rapes whilst a student in England. And then we find out that he was a student in Northern Ireland for 2 years. Now, having looked at the scenario of what he was doing and how he was committing those crimes, the possibility of that person having committed similar crimes, we're talking about, you know, violent drug-related rape in Northern Ireland, is a possibility. Now, if we end up with a situation where a number of victims come forward and say, I was a victim of this person in Northern Ireland, that's a huge demand on the policing resources in Northern Ireland. That didn't happen a lifetime ago. That isn't a legacy case. That has happened within the last number of years in Northern Ireland. That could be a real investigation that kicks off today and would require sufficient experienced specialist skills to investigate to the right standards.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Alison Morris, Roy McComb, thank you. Here's Stephen in Antrim. Good morning, Stephen.
Hi, good morning.
Go ahead, sir.
One of the elements that I don't hear mentioned, I haven't heard John Boucher or any of the senior policing team or the policing board members mention, is the role of part-time reserve police officers. Remember them?
Yeah,
you know, you used to have neighbourhood police officers, people who served their community. And surely that would be, a way of actually measuring what the community and their political representatives really are committing to.
I think another question around all of this, Stephen, is what are the policing board doing about this? And there's a slight complication in that the policing board, who are hearing this testimony from John Boucher as to how bad it is, some of the people sitting in that policing board represent the actual parties who signed off no hard money, no hard commitment to policing.
Yeah.
So you've got that conundrum in the middle of this as well.
You're making my point for me, Stephen. The last time that reservists were mentioned by the policing board was February 2021. Remember COVID? And they used them during COVID. But COVID has come and gone to, you know,
I think the reservists aren't the main story this morning. The core story here this morning is that you have got the top police officer in Northern Ireland telling you that your police service won't be able to keep you out of danger as much as he wants, and talking about catastrophic events. This isn't a story about reservists.
But we know this, Stephen. You see, you are trying to keep this corralled, okay?
I'm trying to keep a senior police officer
that the public respect. You cannot gainsay John Boucher, okay? And John Boucher has made his views and his needs very clear. So
why haven't they given him a a firm yes or a firm no in the programme for government. The up to £215 million that there is for health, but it isn't cast iron guarantee. It's not definitely there. They're going to try to get it. So what have they decided this week?
Well, you see, these are weasel words, Stephen, okay? Because there are politicians that are elected and serve in our assembly who don't believe in policing. No matter how often they say that they do and that they represent all of us, ordinary people such as myself know that this doesn't match the reality on the ground.
Okay.
And police reserves will actually demonstrate, if you'll hear me out, that will demonstrate whether communities believe in policing or they're just using weasel words.
Okay, Stephen, thank you. Morning to you. 030-30-80-55-55. We'll take more of your calls later on this. I want to move on to this row in the GAA over where an Ulster Senior Football Championship match will be played. Antrim were drawn at home to the All-Ireland champions Armagh in October. But in January, they were asked to nominate an alternative venue to accommodate the size of the crowd expected for the game. Antrim had refused, insisting it was their right to play at home, and they're still refusing to shift from that position after yesterday's meeting of the Ulster Competitions Control Committee. They say they still expect to stage the game at home. That's despite Ulster GAA switching the game to Park Esler. In a statement, Ulster GAA say they sympathise with Antrim's situation, but the game will have to move. But you've got a team here saying they ain't going to play it. Sports journalist for the Irish Independent, Conan Doherty, with us this morning. Set this out for us, Conan. Might this game not happen at all now?
Well, it's Antrim's prerogative, really. I feel like I'm always coming on here when there's a GAA row here, Stephen. I mean, there's 16 players playing in an All-Ireland Club final. You had me on. And then, like, you know, we have the like of this. We have the Caton Park argument. And I'm struggling to think how I can sell this to you now. The sport gets you on board of it because there's always some sort of shambles. And now you have an Ulster Championship with the All-Ireland Champions, like you say. And there's just a standoff. And Antrim are well within their rights. They were drawn out first. They were given home draw. And this has happened before. There's been precedent. And the GAA love to use this word, health and safety, because generally what happens in the world, when somebody says health and safety, everybody defers it and they think, oh, well, we can't challenge that. But Kildare had this, for example, when they drew Mayo, and the GAA saw the opportunity to put that game into Croke Park because Mayo would have drawn a big crowd. But Kildare said, no, we're playing in Newbridge. That's our home stadium. And they stood them down. They said, we're not going to Croke Park. We won't be there. We'll be in Newbridge. And they got the game in Newbridge, regardless of whatever the health and safety.
So how come the authorities aren't buckling this time?
I wonder. I really do wonder. I have a suspicion. Do they think that this is because it's Antrim and we can kick them around a little bit? I mean, Donegal had this a few years back in 2013. They were the All-Ireland champions and there was something raised health and safety wise with their grounds. So do you know what we have to think about as well? When the health and safety thing comes up, it's the GAA's dream capacity that they want for a stadium like this, or they want for a game like this. So if you actually just played to what the ground can do, there wouldn't be an issue with that. Like, this game, by my reckoning, should be played, or could be played on a council pitch if that was Antrim's home ground. Because, like, that's where they play. So it's just because we want a bigger crowd at it. We feel like Armagh can attract a bigger crowd.
Well, is it? That's not what they're saying, of course. They're saying that. They're saying, what is the health and safety alleged issue?
Because they want to put a bigger crowd into it. Like, that's what it comes down to. And, like I said, with the Donegal example.
This is down to money. Yeah. You telling me this is down to money?
I think that's what it is. We've lost the McKenna Cup this year, so like the pre-season competitions that usually happen before the National League, like that's a money driver for the GAA. That's gone now. Armagh, the All-Ireland champions, draw a big crowd. And Antrim have been kicked around with this before. In 2019, they ended up playing a game against Tyrone in Armagh, I think it was. And like that was supposed to be their home draw. And then 2 years ago, they had a fight. They were playing Cavan. And they held the ground with that, and they got it at home. Now, just unfortunate that they got hammered in that match, you know, even though they drew up a bit of a bit of support around them and a bit of a rallying cry. But I wonder, because that was Cavan and Antrim, it's not the All-Ireland champions. I wonder, was that easier for the GAA to just, yeah, or the Ulster Council, just to let that let that go through. But right now, it's like there's a bit of a standoff. But if it comes down to it, I honestly don't think the GAA have a leg to stand on, because Corrigan Park will host the Leinster Hurling Championship this year, for example. Dublin Hurlers will be up there playing Antrim. They're hosting National League games. Waterford are coming up soon. Like, it's a fit-for-purpose stadium based on the capacity that it can hold. And if you stick to that, then there's nothing really to talk about.
The former Antrim County GAA board member, Brendan McGrew, with us today. Morning to you, Brendan.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning, the SLP former All-Ireland winner with our man 2002, Justin McNulty. Hello, Justin.
Good morning, Stephen. Good morning, Connor. Brendan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin. Good morning. So, look, Justin, if Antrim stick to their guns and say, we're not going, do you think the Ulster GAA will blink?
I think Antrim will stick to the guns, and it's hard to see how they can back down in this. I want to commend Paddy Cunningham, who was on Good Morning Ulster, who communicated a very reasonable and balanced position. I think it's a courageous call by the Antrim players. I think it's a courageous call by the Antrim management to stick by their players. I admire their bravery and their boldness. And it's hard to see how they can back down. I think they're going to hold to their position very firmly, and it's galvanizing the players. It's bolstering their sense of teamness, and they're standing firmly shoulder to shoulder on this, and it's difficult to see how they will play this game was played anywhere other than in Carden Park.
So what could you have, Brendan? You couldn't have fans turning up to Park Esler and the team not there, could you? No. Like, how's this going to play out?
This will be resolved hopefully before we get to that stage, Stephen. I think what needs to happen here is that all parties involved, and really that's the Ulster Council, the GAA, as well as Antrim, just need to take a... It's better for everybody if the heat comes out of this, because, and if everyone involved in staging the game faces into the facts of the situation, and no one should be under any illusion, Antrim will not play this game outside of Corrigan Park. That's a fact. So it will not take place in Park Esler. That's a fact. So if the game is going to be staged, and there's reasons why, you know, yesterday a bigger crowd in Park Esler and all of that, but this is not Corrigan Park versus Park Esler in Newry. This is Corrigan Park versus no game taking place. And in that situation, everyone's a loser. Antrim, Armagh lose out on a game as part of their championship. Financially, there'll be nobody paying 20 quid a ticket, never mind 4,000 people versus 14,000 people. This is Corrigan Park or no game. It's not Corrigan Park versus Newry. And I think the sooner everyone grasps that reality and works out how best to stage the game in Corrigan Park on April the 12th, then we're in a better situation. We need to get there pretty quickly, because this draw was made in October. It's a crazy thing. This situation has been, and everyone's known about this since October last year. Here we are, a mere 5 weeks or something like that from the game taking place. We need to take the heat out of this, get out of the table, sort it out, and get the game staged at Corrigan Park.
Are Armagh supporting Antrim's position?
They are. Armagh have been very clear. The Armagh manager, Kieran McGeaney, made it very clear that they respect the Antrim position whereby the game should be in Corrigan Park, that they respect the fact that Antrim came out of the hat first. And, you know, if there was ever a problem about us staging a game in Corrigan, then our name should have been in the draw in the first place, or else the Ulster Council should have said, by the way, Antrim can't host home games. But the draw was made. The draw was made, and Antrim came out first. That equals home advantage.
And of course...
This highlights the reality, Stephen. This highlights the reality and reinforces the need and the urgency to have Casement Park development. And I actually was fortunate enough to play on the last Armagh All-Ireland winning team, and in 2023 we went into West Belfast as All-Ireland champions and played Antrim in a packed Casement Park on a sunny Saturday evening, and that's where this would be. And don't forget the symbolism around this. There's immense symbolism around the All-Ireland champions holding the most prestigious trophy in Irish sports coming into West Belfast onto the White Rock Road to play in St John's Club in Corrigan Park, and that's a massively positive symbolic moment, and not to be underestimated, and that sends a huge message for Antrim Gaels, and a really positive message for Antrim Gaels. It's a really positive moment for Antrim Gaels, and that's why they're protecting it, and that's, I fully support them in the protection of that. Also recognising the difficult position this puts the council in, they're dealing with economies of scale, they're dealing with the fact that Armagh has 10,000 season ticket holders who won't be able to be accommodated this match, but there are more season ticket holders who would travel to Timbuktu to follow their team would not begrudge Antrim their home venue here. They would not begrudge this, and Armagh deserves enormous credit for building that fan base, so, the players, the management, and the county board. And Antrim are trying to do similar, and we're supporting them in doing that.
The former DUP special advisor David Graham joining us, and the point was just made. David, good morning to you.
Good
Good morning, David.
Good morning. Good morning, Stephen.
The point was just made a couple of moments ago. Look, if Casement Park was built, the problem wouldn't exist.
Yeah, well, I assume, Stephen, that was why I was being brought on this morning. I mean, in reality, from a sporting point of view, let's take Lorne, who did very well to get into the group stages of the UEFA Conference League. They were able to play their home matches in the qualifiers at Inver Park. And because the stadium didn't meet UEFA expectations, health and safety credentials, it had to move to a stadium that did so, and that stadium was Windsor Park. So I think from a sporting point of view, you know, if my understanding is correct, the GAA are saying, look, this ground isn't big enough, then that's on the GAA because they are saying it doesn't meet health and safety. Now, in reality, so the GAA in this situation, Stephen, are like UEFA. In reality, if, for example, Tobermore United were to pull the likes of Linfield or Glentoran in the Irish Cup, there would be a conversation to be had which would simply say either, are you going to be able to meet health and safety expectations? If the answer is yes, then the wider position is, well, actually, this is a once-in-a-lifetime money-making for your small rural club. Do you want to switch the game to Windsor Park or the Oval for the sake of the conversation? So I'm not quite sure why this is an issue, unless you want to politicise the issue. That's why I assume I've been brought on, Stephen, and have the hypothetical conversation of, if we had Casement Park, therefore then everything would be okay.
The discussion around Casement Park is a real one. It's a live one. For example, last night on The View, Mark Crothers spoke to the Secretary of State, Hilary Benn, and Casement Park was talked about. Have a listen.
What I said to the GAA is I'm not going to make a promise that I cannot keep. If and when I'm in a position to say that the UK government will make a contribution, I will, of course, announce that. But if I am in a position to be able to do that. Look, there's a spending review process, Mark, going on. And as you alluded to in one of your earlier questions, a lot of things have changed, including the fiscal challenge that is facing the UK and many other countries. However, even if there were to be a contribution, in my view, there would still be a gap to be filled. And the executive commitment of £62.5 million dates, I think I'm right in saying, from 2011. Well, there's been a lot of building price inflation since then. So there will need to be an effort to find sources of finance from elsewhere. But let me be clear to you, I'm very keen to see the Casement Park project completed because it matters a great deal to many people in Northern Ireland.
It certainly matters to me. Okay, well, the cost is £260 million, as we understand it. The shortfall is £140 million. Can you give us any sense tonight as to the kind of figure you will be making the case to Treasury to be able to give to the GAA to support the project you say matters so much to you? Of that £140 million, how much could the UK government stump up?
Well, much as you may tempt me or ask me, I'm not going to put a figure on that because there is a spending review process that has got to be completed. But what is very evident from the figures you've just given is there is still a large gap and sources of finance will have to be found from a range of organisations in order to see this project proceed. And there's one other very important factor, Mark. The current planning permission, as I understand it, runs out next summer. And the last thing I think anybody wants is, because no work has started on the site, there has to be a new planning application going through the whole thing, which will delay it even further. So it is important to try and get to a point where some work can start before then.
Well, the Belfast Telegraph's Suzanne Breen told The View that supporters of Casement will be worried by the Secretary of State's comments that we've just played there. And she also thinks the DUP are actively trying to run the clock down on Casement's planning permission.
What is really needed to drive the Casement Park project forward is activism, proactive stance by the Sports Minister, Gordon Lyons, and we are not going to get that. We get inertia on his part. And I think the DUP is trying to run the clock down to when planning permission for Casement runs out next year. I don't think for electoral reasons, for political reasons, I don't think it wants this delivered.
OK, well, the invitation to the Minister to join us to set out his stall is, of course, still on the table. Just very quickly, in a sentence or two, is there pressure on Sinn Féin to see this project delivered?
There is huge pressure on Sinn Féin. I mean, in recent days, we have seen the Alliance Party challenging the DUP stance in Stormont, saying that it's blocking an awful lot of things. But there has been silence from Nationalist's largest party. Michelle O'Neill promised at an Ireland's Future conference last year that Casement would be delivered on her watch. And I think there is unease among Nationalist grassroots. The DUP really seem to be starting to run rings around Sinn Féin again in Stormont. And I think Nationalists will be looking to Sinn Féin to assert itself more and to deliver a strong message to the DUP that this has to go ahead. Because there is a history here of blocking of major infrastructure projects in Nationalist areas. Casement is a totemic matter for the Nationalist community.
Well, the DUP spokesman in sport, Stephen Dunn, has told the Nolan Show the following. We reject Suzanne Breen's assessment on The View. The funding, as per Ravenhill Winter Park, has been freely available to the GAA. Mr Dunn, who's an MLA, says the delay has been mainly due to challenges by West Belfast residents. Commentators would do well to reflect the factual reality. Rather than trying to make this a rights issue, the West Belfast residents have every right to want their safety concerns to be addressed. The executive remains committed to the 2011 funding agreement. The fact remains that there's a gap between the proposal on the table and funding available. Brendan Mulgrew?
Yeah, the most accurate part of that statement, Stephen, is the last sentence. That's the hold-up at the minute. It's the gap between, it's the funding gap. Issues around, you know, those who were opposed to the stadium. That's dealt with. That's the red herring. Been through the courts. Been JR'd. Planning permission is in place. So that's all been dealt with. There is a funding gap. And on the other hand, there is, frankly, a lack of urgency from the executive about addressing that funding gap. And we were told time and again that all parties would work together. We'd be around one table working out how to fill this funding gap. The British government and others have been dragging
the feet. But how come? If Sinn Féin is the biggest party in Northern Ireland, and whatever leverage they do or don't have over the DUP, how come they haven't been able to get the DUP to move on this? Might be a question. Sean, morning, Sean. Thanks for calling us.
Good morning. How are you?
Go ahead. I'm all right. Go ahead, sir.
That's good. No, when the open draw was made, I think Antrim should stand their ground because, you know, if anybody else, if the draw was made somewhere else, they would have to play it, you know. That's my stance.
So what do you think? Do you think the authorities will have to blink here? They've moved it already.
They have moved it already, but it's not right. Antrim should stand their ground, definitely.
Even if that means no game being played?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I'll stand my ground.
What's this Park Esler place like?
Park Esler, it's a good stadium, you know. I've been in the whole lot of times, and it's a good stadium. But why should Antrim, the draw was made and it was Antrim home venue?
And Sammy next morning, Sammy. Thank you. Sean, morning, Sammy.
I have a simple solution. There's a stadium in Belfast that has received hundreds of millions of pounds over the last 10 or 12, 15 years, while all the other stadiums haven't got a penny.
Spit it out. What are you talking about?
Play Antrim's GAA home games at Windsor Park.
Aye, dead on. You think that's going to happen?
Well, hold on a minute. Glen Torn don't get any money. GAA doesn't get any money. Crusaders, Cliftonville, nobody gets any money. And there's a queer, strange thing happens in this country that Windsor Park has hundreds and hundreds. They're talking about demolishing the North Stand now. And it's not 20 years old.
We're talking about this GAA game.
They deserve a home game, and I would have been on your show whenever they went back into government. If I remember clearly, the main reason why the DUP went back into Stormont was to stop Casement getting built.
Well, I'm not sure they would agree with that, but thank you for your call this morning. The 10 o'clock news coming up right now. Thanks to our guests, Conan and Brendan and Justin and David. Good morning, everyone. Don't forget Nolan Live is on the iPlayer. If you want to go back and watch that when we had a look at all of the programme for government, commitments or lack of them. Emma Little-Pengelly, Deputy First Minister in that programme. It's on the BBC iPlayer right now. Next, John Paul. contacted the Nolan Show after hearing our coverage on patients unable to leave hospital as beds or care packages were not available. Good morning, John Paul.
Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
I'm doing all right, and thank you for contacting me with your story. Your mum has complex needs. She's got dementia, and she's been in hospital for over a month.
Yeah, well, yes, this current episode, yeah.
And she's deemed medically fit to leave, right?
Yes, she is. She had a wee urinary tract infection, and that's cleared now. So as far as the medical doctors are concerned, she's able to leave the hospital, but she has nowhere to go.
And being in hospital for a month is a long time. Being in hospital for a few days is a long time.
Yes, Stephen, so that's very frustrating for her.
What's she saying about it?
Well, basically because of her dementia, she doesn't really understand why she can't leave, you know, and it's virtually impossible to explain it to her in a way that she'll understand, you know.
And yours is then yet another story, like we've heard day after day on this programme. People, often elderly, and they're just not getting the service that they should. They're being left in hospital when they shouldn't be there.
That's exactly it. It's whenever you give out those statistics the other day, that it kind of shocked me, you know.
And your mum's one of them.
She is, and you know, I fully understand that there's it's a question of resources and all the rest of it, you know. But in the meantime, I have to deal with it, you know. So I just, you know, the more she has to, the longer she has to stay in hospital, the more frustrated she will get, you know. She hasn't really got any stimulus down there at all, you know. She's got two options, and that's lie in her bed all day or sit in her chair all day, really, you know. It can't be good for her.
Sad. No. It's very, very sad. I'm very frustrating for you because you're trying to fight to help her and you're not getting anywhere.
Well, that's it. I mean, I didn't come on here to criticise anybody or anything like that, you know, because truthfully, anybody I've come into contact with about my mother's case, they do their best. They really do. They try their best. But the system, as you well know, the system is broken in a lot of different ways, you know. So, I mean, even if she does get lucky and get a place, it could be anywhere in the country, you know.
What are they currently saying to you?
Who's that now? The hospital?
The authorities. What are they, the hospital, about your mum. What are they currently saying?
When she went in the hospital at the start of February, the care home phoned me and asked me to go up and accompany her to the hospital. And, of course, she had to sit in the ambulance for quite a while as well before she was admitted. I went up to see her the next morning. I had to take things to her, you know, clothes and toiletries and stuff like that. So I had literally only arrived at the hospital when I got a call from the care home to say, your mum has been discharged, can you come up and collect her stuff? So she is, she's effectively homeless. She's fit to be discharged, but she has nowhere to go. And until a place becomes available, she'll have to stay in Antrim Hospital. That's because that's the way the system works. Now, the problem is, as you said at the top of the piece, she has complex needs. Which means placing her becomes just that little bit more difficult. You have to find a home that will be able to accommodate her needs. You know, bearing in mind they have duties of care to staff and other residents and all the rest of it, you know.
So what are you going to do?
Well, there's very little I can do, Stephen. It's just, it's a waiting game, really. Like I say, we might get lucky. She could get placed next week, say, or she could be still sitting there in 6 months' time. I know you had a lady on your show a few days ago saying one of her relatives was stuck in hospital for 8 months. And the thought of that is, you know, doesn't bear thinking about, really. It won't do any good, that's for sure.
So she's there. She's stuck there.
She's stuck there. I'll be up to later on today to see her. Myself and my brother, my nephew. She has no stimulus up there. You know, there's nothing really to keep her occupied. She can't really read books. She's got poor eyesight as well. That affects a lot of things that she can and can't do. She needs help with everything, Stephen. She can't get out of bed on her own. She can't get out of a chair on her own. She needs help with her toileting needs. She needs help with feeding as well, you know. So it's partly a dementia thing. It's partly she's very frail, physically very frail. She has no strength. She only weighs about 43 kilo. And on top of all that, she has quite poor eyesight as well. Which
doesn't
help.
She's at the stage of her life where she's relying on the Northern Ireland Health Service to be able to treat her with the service that gives her dignity and respect.
Yes, Stephen, yeah. And you know the ironic thing is she was a geriatric nurse all her working career.
My goodness, this is what she's getting back.
Well, that's it. And, you know, like I say, I didn't come on here to criticise any one individual or any organisation.
I don't think you're doing that, but you're essentially saying your mum deserves better than this.
Well, doesn't she? I mean, it's like I say, it's the system. The system is definitely broken. I know there's serious issues with money and resources and all the rest of it. So we're stuck in limbo, Stephen, and that's just it. We could get lucky or it could drag on and on and on. But the longer it drags on, it really won't do her any good at all. And she's not allowed to come home. Because of her situation, she can't risk assess. She can't appreciate the risks. She's also, she's at quite severe risk of falling again, you know, unless there's somebody there to supervise her. She has to have somebody there more or less at all times. She's not the only one in that situation, Stephen. I appreciate that. But, that's the reason why I contacted your show, is because of the statistics you gave out.
Yeah.
The other day where, you know, the longest wait in the Northern Trust area is something like 4 months.
Yeah, I've got the stats here, actually, because we read them the other day. So if we look at the Northern Trust, these are updated ones now. Total of 32 patients in an acute hospital delayed awaiting a permanent care home placement.
Yeah.
26 general, 6 dementia. Your mum must be one of them.
Yes.
Total days in hospital, 1,518. My goodness, our longest
wait, as you know, Stephen,
is 128 days. It's over 4 months someone's waiting in a hospital.
And
should
as you
be
know,
discharged.
Those 32 people, it's not like a taxi rank system where it's next in line. It's you have to find a care home setting where they are able to accommodate her needs. You know, so. If they can't place her in the Northern Trust area, they have to look further afield. So, she could end up anywhere. That's another worry. If she was placed far away, I wouldn't get to see her as often. She's basically alone because she's in her own wee world, you know. I asked her the other day, do you know what year it is? And she told me straight away, without any hesitation, she told me it was 1941, which is actually 4 years before she was born.
I want to share something with you.
Yes.
We went to the Northern Trust about your mother.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, the response that they have given completely obliterated any mention of your mother. They not only didn't refer to her, they didn't address any of the questions about her. Mm-hmm. Now, these people at these trusts work for you. And we went to the Northern Trust and we listed the details about your mum and when she was admitted into hospital. And we asked the following: why has there been a delay in providing your mum a suitable package to meet her needs? When can she expect to be provided with a suitable care package that meets her needs?
All right. Yeah.
And they completely ignored any reference to your mother. They completely swerved around even acknowledging that we had asked something as simple in terms of they knew what we were asking. When can she expect to get out?
Yeah.
Well, what I would say this morning.
Sorry, Steve.
What I would say. Go ahead. You first. No, you go first.
I was just going to say that doesn't really surprise me because they can't really answer that question. You know, how long is a piece of string? It all comes down to availability, and it ultimately comes down to a question of resources, and there just isn't enough being put in. But there's, you know, you had the story about the police service at the top of the show. They're, you know, the chief constable and all that. They're under the same pressures with manpower and funding and all the rest. But so, yeah, it comes down to a question of policy, and that goes back to Stormont. You know, where do the priorities lie? But in the meantime, yeah, we just have to soldier on. You know.
Yeah, I get that. But in the meantime, your mother's sitting staring at four walls without the appropriate stimulus that you say she could have. You're being told as a family that she's medically fit to be released. She's in there a month. The longest waiting time is 4 months. She's just stuck there.
Yeah.
And for anybody listening to this program right now, this could be you or your mum or your dad as well.
Yes, Stephen, we never expected to be in this position. I mean, she fell at home here in July, at the end of July 2023. She fell and injured her hip. And she was very lucky that I was able to come up and I only live, well, at the time I only lived down the street. I was able to come up and get an ambulance called because, like I say, the dementia thing was probably starting the beginning before she even fell. You know, I was noticing just little changes here and there. She was getting unsteady on her feet. She was getting a little bit paranoid about money. You know, I was worried about her. She had very little strength, so I was worried about her dropping a kettle of boiling water or turning the stove on and forgetting about it and things like that, you know. Yeah. So, she got a new phone around that time and she couldn't work it because of her eyesight. She can't see the buttons very well. But just by pure luck, she managed to hit the redial button and called my sister-in-law in Galway. And then I got an emergency call from my brother late on that night saying, "Mum's fallen, you better get up there quick." And I've been here ever since, dealing with the issues, you know. The Northern Trust, I have to say, at the very start, were quite aggressive in, you know, they were talking about taking the house, control of the house, and all sorts. I had to supply, you wouldn't believe, the information I had to supply to them, all related to her finances and stuff. So all they wanted was money.
Well, I guess what they were doing was protecting the public purse, weren't they?
Well, that's fair enough.
As they're entitled to do.
Fair enough, but it was just, I found the whole thing quite aggressive, considering I was trying to deal with an injured family member. No, you know,
I hear you. I hear you.
It didn't help. They weren't very compassionate about it. Let's put it like that. You know, so.
Well, they're saying in this statement that they've given us, in which they have ignored any reference to your mum, as I've told you, that they regret the distress caused to patients and their families. they're experiencing considerable challenges.
So
in other words, when you as a family through the BBC say, look, when's my mum likely to get out? They don't even say to you through providing us with an answer, we don't know. They just ignore the question about your mum. Now, I would say to the Northern Trust this morning, is that befitting of a caring health trust? And this man wants to know what is ahead for his mum, how likely the wait is likely to be. And we're going back to you again on his behalf, and we're going to ask you if you're prepared to even contact him. There's not even anything in this statement from the Northern Trust offering to reach out to you. And we'll be asking them why. Listen, thank you very much. Thank you for talking to us today.
And, thank you, Steve. Thanks for your time.
And I know it's a lot of pressure on you. Look, over the last few weeks, again, the Nolan Show has been trying to listen to the feedback we're getting from you. There are lots and lots of you being affected by this now. If we just remind you, family of Keith Murray had been waiting in Belfast Royal Victoria Hospital for 4 weeks. Lindsay contacted the show about her dad, who was told he would have to leave his care home as they couldn't meet his needs. Have a listen to what they told the Nolan Show.
The care home manager, and I have to say we both supported her point of view that he couldn't return there because he had a duty of care to her staff and her residents. So he ended up in a critical care ward and he's still there.
He's still in hospital?
Now. He's still in hospital. He's been there for 4 weeks.
We're in a similar position with my father, who is in a care home at the minute. So his current home, potentially talking about placing him in a mental health unit because they have nowhere else to put him.
How do you feel about that?
Extremely distressing for him. I feel absolutely disgusted, Stephen, and I feel let down by the whole system.
And then Linda got in touch with the Nolan Show after her mum had been in hospital, wait for this, for 8 months.
She's in the Royal Victoria Hospital and she's been there for 8 months. Seven of those, you know, would be waiting for the bed. Roughly, we're just talking rough numbers here.
Linda, I'm nearly falling off my seat.
Yeah.
Your mother is able to leave hospital and has been waiting on a bed for 8 months.
Well, a month of that would take off a month, but 7 months ready for discharge. She had a stroke, and with that she has episodes of delirium and dementia. She is one of these people with the complex needs, and for that reason keeps getting turned down from care home placements. We're looking at 30 care homes at the minute with refusals to take her.
Ruth Barry, listening to this from the Alzheimer's Society. Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning, Stephen.
So people who can't speak for themselves, people who are in stages of confusion because of their disease, are being left in hospital for months when they should be out.
Yeah, well, Stephen, I just want to say thank you to the callers for calling in and to shine the light on this issue. To set a bit of context, you know, dementia in Northern Ireland is growing, and we have around 25,000 people living with dementia in Northern Ireland, which is making them one of the biggest groups drawing on social care. Now, that figure is set to rise to over 51% to around 37,000 by 2040. So we know that the issue is growing now and the issue will continue to grow in the next number of years. What we are saying as an Alzheimer's Society is that social care is not the priority it needs to be amongst decision makers. And there are things that are happening, you know, at departmental level around trying to increase support, but we are simply not seeing that priority amongst decision makers. Dementia is a progressive disease. There is no cure. It affects memory, problem solving, language and communication care. So as you've heard from your callers, there can be complex needs which people don't often associate with dementia because there's not as much awareness as there needs to be. So care needs to be tailored. But in Northern Ireland at the moment, and is the case across England and Wales, there's currently no legal requirement for care staff to undertake any dementia training. So, you know, we all want the best possible care for the people we love, Stephen, and we've heard that from your callers throughout the last week. Alzheimer's Society brought out research the later part of last year, which was called Because We're Human Too, and we were showing that investing in dementia training reaped benefits and is hugely cost-effective. It can improve the quality of life for the person living with dementia, for their carers, but more importantly, by investing in, you know, good, high-quality dementia training, it can reduce agitation, it can save money both at GP level, reduce GP visits. It can also save money at the A&E level, where you're cutting emergency hospital admissions.
I'm learning about this. I'm learning about the acute problem that there is in this through this programming. And we're just continuing to get person after person contacting us about this. Mervyn, for example. Morning, Mervyn.
Good morning. I just had the phone in. The young fellow was on there talking about his mother. It just sounded like me speaking. I went through all this. Our mother passed away in January last year. But the vascular dementia, the poor eyesight, diabetes, we went through all that. And then, and I'm not criticising her, but the time she was in hospital, as soon as they assessed her to leave, they expected her to go. So they'd done their job. We then, and thank goodness for two sisters, we managed to get her into a nursing home where she really responded to the stimulus of having activities to do rather than just lying in a room all day in her bed or in a chair. So I just had to phone in to give that fellow support because I know what it's like going through it.
And how long was your mum stuck in hospital for?
Well, She was in and out of hospital probably 3-4 times, probably for maybe a month each time, because she fell. Like, Mike, and you know, I thought she'd been 6 rounds of boxing at times, because when she fell, it was just a case of her head hitting the ground, you know, and breaking things. So then she was just lying in hospital in the bed. So, you know, we were just visiting her, and as soon as they patched her up and the bruise and all was fixed, they just wanted her out again, you know. So I said,
and were you able to find a place easily her out?
Well, yeah, I live up in Ballymena, but my sister's got around to a nice place down in Newton Ards, which sort of suited them a bit better, and I didn't mind travel up and down as much as possible we could do. But she definitely responded. You do need the help. Now, as I think of the two sisters, because, you know, for women's things, they were helping her that way. But, you know, there has to be a place for elderly people in this country for a safe place to go. They do need specialists to help, you know.
And it must be just, I don't know, I don't know how you face. You see your mum, and you know who your mum is, and then
it's hard. And that's why I had the phone in, because that man, everything he was saying, it just sounded like what I was saying at the time, and then through all that, you know, and then it is so tough, especially your mother that you've known all your life. You want the best for her. You want her to have the best treatment. You want her to have some sort of end of care in her life, you know, end of life care.
Of course you do.
And say, I just had to phone in to give him a wee bit of support and wish him all the best.
The Northern Trust have been back to us to say that they will continue to work with the family to help. So that would suggest that they have been working with the family. And they say that this shows the challenging situation that's facing all trusts across the region in terms of availability of care beds. I'll tell you what, if we're at the stage now where, you know, we can't care for the most elderly and the most vulnerable. Like, what's next?
Exactly.
Thank you.
We're all getting old someday.
Thank you, Mervyn. Thank you, Ruth.
No problem. Thank you.
Alzheimer's Society. Thank you very much. I'm on 5 Live tonight at 10 o'clock for the Nolan Show that goes across the UK. And we'll see you tonight. at 10 or back here Monday at 9.
Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.